morning. We appreciate your coming in these treacherous times. We may or may not, and probably may not, have students come in because schools are generally closed around the state. But if we do and you hear disturbance, that's what's happening. Okay? I will now call the first case for today, 07-18-983, Heritage Farms, Inc. versus Markel Insurance Company et al. And Charles D. Smith will argue on behalf of Heritage Farms. Mr. Smith?
Morning. May it please the court. As Chief Justice Abrahamson pointed out, my name is Charles Schmidt. I represent the petitioners, who we've referenced as Heritage Farms, and I've probably referenced as Heritage Farms throughout the argument. There's two issues in front of the court today. Both deal with the applicability of Section 2621, which is the Civil Liability for Forest Fire statute. On behalf of Heritage Farms, I respectfully submit that the court should rule, one, that 2621 applies to all persons responsible for setting forest fires, not just to railroad corporations. And two, that 2621 applies to all negligence responsible for causing forest fires, not merely to gross negligence. With regard to the first issue, I submit that the statute's clear on its face, and I think that's reflected in the DNR interpretations, which have been consistent since at least 1974, based on the record that we've seen and that we've submitted to the court. It's also clear in the historical context of the statute, and it's clear in the drafting history of the statute. With regard to the second issue, it's true that this court, back in 1914, put a judicial gloss on the term negligence, as it appears in the statute, but the court overruled that gloss in Bielski in 1962 when it abolished the concept of gross negligence from Wisconsin common. Since that point, the legislature has amended 2621 on at least one occasion in 1977. It didn't stick the term gross negligence back into the statute, and given that the legislature is presumed to know what the court is doing, I submit that that reflects the legislature intended, as it initially wrote, that the statute applies to all negligence. First issue, the only issue that the Court of Appeals addressed, given its dispositive nature, really boils down to the defense's argument that the lead phrase of 2621, sub 1, because it references a statute that applies to railroad corporations, among others, somehow limits the application of 2621. So that really what the defense is trying to do, and what I believe that the Court of Appeals erroneously did, was take the expansive term in addition to and construe that as some sort of limiting term insofar as that the reference to 2620 applies to 2621. Now, with regard to 2620, I think we need to clarify a couple of things, and I think that the DNR did a good job in its amicus brief pointing out that 2620 does not just apply to railroad corporations. That in itself is a fallacy. It applies to all corporations. And in particular, it covers not only railroad corporations, but it covers donkey engines, which are winches that pull logs for logging purposes. It covers threshing machines, for example, boilers, virtually any type of engine that could cause a forest fire. And 2620 applies to any corporation. It doesn't say railroad corporations, at least in the penalties provision, which is referenced in 2621. It does, however, elsewhere in the statute say railroad corporation. So if the legislature had deemed fit to apply the penalties only to railroad corporations, it would only be logical that it would take the term railroad corporations that it used elsewhere and insert that in the penalty provision.
Mr. Smith, do you think that we are in any way required to give any deference to the interpretation of the Department of Natural Resources in regard to the statute?
I believe that you are, and I think that due deference should be given simply because the legislature unquestionably charged the DNR with applying and enforcing all of the forest fire statutes, all of Chapter 26. So while there is some issue as to how often it's applied this and, you know, how frequently it has applied it, The fact of the matter is the legislature gave them the authority. They exercised the authority as a deterrent effect.
Well, what does due deference mean?
Well, I think that if you've got, if the DNR has looked at this and consistently interpreted the statute, which it has, and their interpretation is reasonable, the court should defer to what the DNR has done. And the DNR's interpretation...
Doesn't it mean unless there's another more reasonable one?
No, I think the case law says not more reasonable. It says as long as it's reasonable, the court should defer. And again, I don't believe that there is a more reasonable one. I think that brings us back to what does the statute say on its face. I'm not arguing that the DNR has somehow moved away from the plain text of the statute and made this up to its own ends. What the DNR has done is looked at the statute, come up with the only reasonable interpretation in my mind, and said this is how we're going to apply the statute as a deterrent to prevent people from burning down forests in Wisconsin.
Counsel, does it make any difference that the DNR interpretation is not the result of some sort of formal proceeding or formal request for a determination, but rather seems to just have popped out sort of from nowhere? Does that make a difference as far as deference?
Well, I haven't seen anything that said that some sort of formal committee meeting is necessary for an agency interpretation to be an agency interpretation. And I find it difficult to believe that the DNR would publish these statewide materials, including guidelines on the statutes back in 1974 applicable to forest fires. There were two separate newsletters that it sent out to all the taxpayers in Wisconsin that are in the Forest Protection Program. I think the best piece of evidence is the fact that the foreign burn permit that the DNR issues to people that want to burn and that it issued in this particular case has that particular interpretation. So while I don't know whether a committee actually met on this and whether there was some sort of history to this, frankly, it's not part of the record. Again, this is what the DNR has done. Another element beside the DNR interpretations is the historical context. At the time that this statute was originally enacted in 1905, it was part of what was really a rash of these statutes coming out across the country, some earlier, some a bit later, but they all had very similar language insofar as they required double damages. As the defense has pointed out, they don't always have this introductory language, but the intent behind the statutes is very clear. Forest fires were a big concern. None of these statutes, however, show any concern in particular about railroad corporations. And in fact, the record that is before the court shows that while railroads were responsible for a significant number of forest fires, so were a number of other things. In fact, arson, at least later on, appears to be the top concern.
Counselor, when I look back at the 1905 statutes, they were put together in a little bit of a different framework than we have now. But the predecessor to 2621 appears in Section 18 of that particular version of the statute, and it refers back to, quote, the preceding section of this act, and the preceding section before 18 is 17. And all of the conduct in Section 17 involves pulling something down a railroad track. Now, this conduct doesn't involve pulling something down a railroad track. Can you explain for me this historic context of the statute and why you think that is not important?
Well, I think that there's three difficulties with that analysis. The first is that the statute as it was originally passed actually referred to the preceding sections with an S.
I think that says section. I'm looking right at here. It says, in addition to the penalties provided in the preceding section, singular, of this act, the United States and the state, the county, and private owners whose property is injured. So I'm looking at something that was copied out of the laws of the state of Wisconsin. Now, I assume this is correct. I don't know. I might.
Well, that's discussed in the amicus brief. Mm-hmm.
It may be.
I don't have the specific page in front of me, and I apologize.
But
the DNR did address that. The bill, as it was originally passed, said sections, plural, apparently through a transcription error. We have no other record as to how it referred to section later on. But be that as it may.
That's described in pages 7 and 8 of the amicus brief.
Thank you.
I understand the amicus. I'd like to hear from him.
The fact of the matter is that the preceding section is not limited merely to railroad corporations, as I pointed out. It covers a number of other things.
Because my concern was that it appeared to be limited to people using something to pull something down railroad tracks. And that's kind of what I wanted you to speak to. Does it have to be limited to pulling something down railroad tracks, or are other kind of activities, in your view, included in that section?
Well, I guess the scope of 2120 applies to any corporation, as we pointed out in our brief. The penalty provisions specifically say any corporation. But I think that brings us back to the fundamental problem in the defense's analysis, and what I submit was the fundamental problem in the Court of Appeals analysis, is that the introductory language in 2621 says, in addition to the penalties provided.
I'm sorry, I'm not making myself clear. I want to focus on just the statutes in 1905.
Okay.
Okay, and I understand your argument, and it's well put for the current statute. I'm trying to figure out what's there and what may not be there. And I am asking you whether Section 17 of the 1905 statute involved any other activity except pulling something by some type of a force down a railroad track. And that's what I'm interested in kind of focusing on for the minute.
Yes, I do believe that it did.
Okay.
And as I pointed out, it applies to donkey engines, a number of other things that don't require a railroad track. Basically, it applies to any engine that existed at the time, possibly short of automobiles.
Okay, so it doesn't have to be any kind of an engine that's operated on a railroad track. A donkey engine, threshing engine, you assume would be like to be out in the fields threshing hay or that sort of thing. Is that what
A donkey engine is basically a power winch, and loggers frequently used it. They would cut down a tree, hook a rope to one end to a stationary winch, and they'd haul the logs into one location so they could load them onto something else, a cart or perhaps even a railroad car.
Okay, so your position is that just by its face, Section 17 doesn't involve just things that are either railroad company involved or engines that use the railroad tracks to move things.
That's correct.
Okay, fine. Thank you. That was my question.
Going back to the legislative history, I think it's also important to point out that in 1977, there was what really was the last major amendment to the statute. In 1977, the statute was clarified to say that it applies to all forest fires. There is no direct object in the statute saying, listing the tortfeasors to whom the penalties apply. So given the scope of Chapter 26 and the broad legislative intent of Chapter 26 to protect and sanction conduct that can harm our forests, it seems as though the legislature intended the statute to broadly apply. In 1977, the court did one other thing. The legislature did one other thing. What the record reflects is that the legislature intended to broaden the applicability of the statute. It did not intend to narrow it, and that's reflected by the fact that the senator who was responsible for putting this amendment into play covered a district that included Juneau County. Juneau County was a county that included 3 of the top 10 biggest forest fires the preceding year. All 3 of those forest fires occurred as a result of arson, not as a result of railroads. In fact, as the DNR points out in its brief, only 1 of the top 10 forest fires, and one of the smallest ones at that, was the result of a railroad. So I think there's a safe assumption that this particular senator was concerned with forest fires in his district that had to do with arson, not railroad corporations, particularly given the fact that railroad-related fires had significantly declined by that point in Wisconsin history. Since what the court has to do to come up with the decision that the Court of Appeals did is graft a lot of extra language onto the statute as it stands. It has to say not only in addition to the penalties provided in Section 2620, but go on to say that the state and county and private owners whose property is injured or destroyed as the result of a forest fire can recover, and then add the new language, from the list of tortfeasors in 2620 who violate 2620, and then go on to include the double damage language. The legislature didn't deem fit to put that in there. It left the statute with no direct object. Clearly, it is reasonable to assume that the legislature intended the statute to broadly apply.
Mr. Schmidt, could I ask you, what exactly happened to cause this fire?
The factual basis?
Yes.
Jeffrey Knack, who worked for Lake of the Woods Campground, he was a volunteer of sort, but he was very close with the owner of the campground. He's delegated a number of duties. Among other things, he would burn this massive burn pile. The record shows that in early March, he got the burn permit, presumably the same day. He couldn't remember if it was the same day or next day. He burned this 20-foot by 10-foot high burn pile that had these huge old stumps in it, all sorts of campground debris, etc. He sat outside drinking all day. In fact, there was evidence in the record that he had a problem with drinking. I think that the owner of the campground said that he had an issue with drinking. So he stood out there drinking all day. And at the end of the day, he walked away from the fire. There's some dispute as to whether his original story or his later story was correct. But originally, when the DNR came out to investigate, he said, "I just assumed the snow would put it out." Later on, when he gave a statement to his insurance company, he said, "Well, I actually covered it up with snow, and I assumed the snow would put it out." Obviously, the snow did not put it out. Huge stumps, as the DNR representatives and a number of experts testified, can smolder for months. In this particular case, it smoldered under a layer of ash for about 6 weeks, and then when the weather got clear, the snow melted, high winds and dry conditions picked up, blew the top cover off, and sparks blew out from these stumps, igniting the surrounding area.
Are you saying, I'm looking at the burning permit now.
Okay.
Let's see. Fire must be attended at all times and be total extinguished before you leave. Did he not do that?
Yeah, it's very clear that he didn't extinguish it before he left. That is correct.
Do we know what the wind was that day?
Well, there's a difference between the day that he started it, which was on, I want to say, March 3rd. It may have been March 4th of 03. And it was 6 weeks later that the wind and the dry conditions existed that blew the top off the smoldering burn pile. So the wind on the day that the fire started was very, very high, exceedingly dry conditions.
What I'm really getting at is, did you make a case at trial that this was more than mere negligence?
Well, we didn't make the case because we weren't asked to. The court had already kicked out our claim under 2621, so we couldn't say, "Well, Judge, you know what, you kicked it out, but just in case we appeal, why don't we put a couple more questions on the verdict?" We didn't have that opportunity. Could we prove gross negligence? Given the circumstances, I believe we could. Particularly the fact that he stood out there drinking all day and didn't do, at least in his initial statement, he didn't do anything to put out this fire. And given the size of the fire and the conditions, anyone in Northwoods knows that you can't leave a fire unattended. In fact, that's pointed out right on the burn permit.
So if the court were to decide that you have to have gross negligence, that wouldn't be fatal to your case, is that right?
It wouldn't be fatal, but it would make things much more difficult. We'd have to go back and retry a four-week trial again.
Well, what you seem to be saying is that 2621.1 applies to the whole world.
It applies to anybody that causes a forest fire as the result of willfulness, malice, or negligence.
Okay, and forest fire is so very broadly defined, isn't it? And really, I mean, you have willfulness,
malice.
But now, if we're going to apply the ordinary negligence, well, that's not too difficult. I mean, that's going to apply to all kinds of people who are just ordinary citizens.
Well, I agree that negligence is certainly a lower standard than the first two, malice or willfulness. But the legislature realizes that forest lands are something that contribute a huge percentage of Wisconsin's income. We've got tourism, we've got hunting, we've got a number of other things that we need to protect. And the stump value of burned down trees doesn't always cover it as far as those things are concerned. So the legislature sought to impose double damages, just as it does in a number of other circumstances in the statutes. I don't think it's up to us to second guess whether they were wise in doing it. I think the issue is really, is this court going to take a 50-year step backwards and basically amend the statute to say gross negligence when in fact it does say negligence?
Well, but the court in 1914 basically did say that this language implies some sort of gross negligence. Willfulness, malice, and gross negligence. And at the time, of course, our ideas about negligence are perhaps a little different from what they are now.
I think that last point is the factor that drove the court's decision. I think the underlying premise of the court's decision was that it was trying to ameliorate the effects of contributory negligence at the time. Back then, Wisconsin applied the 1% rule. If the plaintiff was at fault at all for the fire, even 1%, they couldn't recover anything. So the court said, well, you know what, now we're going to read negligence to be gross negligence and get rid of that. You can't compare apples to oranges. So if the plaintiff is negligent and the defendant is grossly negligent, the defendant still picks up the tab.
We didn't have any dissent in the Palsgraf case in 1914.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch
that. We didn't have any dissent in the Palsgraf case in 1914. We hadn't adopted that dissent. I mean, there were more concepts of duty and not kind of having a duty to the whole world. I mean, if you want this statute to apply to everyone who sets a fire and can satisfy the requirements for negligence, I mean, isn't it rather astounding to say, yeah, anybody who sets a fire and doesn't do everything in the burning permit and it causes a huge, huge damages, they're going to get double damages and attorney's fees, and they're going to have to pay all the cost of cleaning up, or fighting the fire for the municipality. That's pretty heavy, isn't it?
That seems like a pretty good deterrent for the DNR, doesn't it? I agree with you that negligence was very different at the time. But the fact is the court got rid of gross negligence in the Bielski decision. The legislature, if it had truly meant gross negligence, could have come back and said, you know what, you guys goofed up. It could have stuck the term gross negligence in the statute, or recklessness, or whatever else it wanted. I think that if it had done so, it would have rendered the term negligence totally superfluous. The gross negligence is really akin to willfulness and malice. Why would the legislature stick that term in there if it didn't mean negligence? And to address the expansive scope, yes, it would be more expansive, but this wouldn't be the only double damage statute. For example, we've got the dog bite statute, which for all intents and purposes is a strict liability statute. There are certain circumstances where the legislature has deemed fit to address certain conduct that's so detrimental or so potentially harmful with double damages as a deterrent to keep people from not using, or to prevent people from using a lack of due care. I think this is one of them.
In Wisconsin, I think we take our timber seriously. And so I think of the timber trespasses. You're talking about statutes that have double damages, or in some ways timber trespass now can have quadruple damages plus reasonable attorney's fees. What, if any, correlation is there between timber trespass, which indicates one of these examples when you can have double or quadruple damages if you come across and cut down my timber on my territory, on my land, and this legislation?
Well, I think that the statute that you're referring to, I believe it's 2609.
That's correct.
I think it shows that really the fundamental flaw in the Court of Appeals analysis. Under 2609, if I were to walk onto your property and cut down some of your trees, even if I used due care, even if I wasn't negligent, you could still sue me for double damages. The legislature, for whatever reason, decided that, as you put it, trees are a pretty valuable commodity in this state. That should be sanctioned with double damages.
I didn't do the legislative history of 2609, but I know that we have cases, of course, in the 1800s and around the early 1900s, actually more cases than you would expect, dealing with timber trespass. That was an area of litigation because of the nature of our state at that time. Do you know anything about the history of 2609?
I don't, other than simply I have the statute in front of me, okay. And I can tell you what year it was enacted, but frankly, I did not do the legislative history on it either. I see that my light is red. Could I just make one more comment on that? With regard to the example I just pointed out, with the trespass, that's a strict liability statute insofar as the double damages is concerned. If I were to come onto your property using the same example, but I were to burn down your trees, even if I did it on purpose, I wouldn't be subject to double damages under the Court of Appeals analysis. I think that shows the difficulty. Why would the legislature choose to sanction conduct that, while harmful, is not deliberate and is not as potentially dangerous as a fire, and then choose not to apply double damages to something that is potentially far, far more dangerous, as we've seen in this particular case? Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. McCoy, representing Markel Insurance Company.
Good morning, Chief Justice Abrahamson and the members of the court. As indicated, my name is John McCoy, and I represent the respondents in this case that I refer to generally as Markel. We are here to ask the court to affirm the decision of the trial court that it made on two separate occasions and the unanimous circuit court, Court of Appeals, concluding that Section 26.21, sub 1, applies only to those corporations under 26.20. Throughout the course of these hearings on this statute, that particular statute, 26.20, has been referred to as the Railroad Corporation Statute. And perhaps that's a misnomer. We do know that it is a particular group of corporations conducting activity, which almost exclusively applies to railroad corporations. There is some reference to a threshing machine under there and one other type of equipment. But clearly, the work done by Markel, which is really the Lake of the Woods Campground in this case, that's the named defendant, and Mr. Knack, who is a volunteer, not an employee, are not of those organizations or corporations found under 2620. And to the degree that that analysis makes more sense, we'd ask the court to look at it that way. Essentially, though, it has been referred to a railroad corporation. It clearly, 26.21 sub 1, talks about 2620 as a reference point. It refers to additional damages in addition to the penalties under 2620. If it had elected, the legislature had elected to apply that statute more broadly, it could have eliminated that and talked about all persons. It could have incorporated all persons as defined under 2614, which deals with damages for acts on forest fires by all persons. It did not elect to do that. it elected to limit the application of 26.21 sub 1 to those corporations that were identified in 2620. Now, the appellants improperly suggest to the court, or the petitioners, that 26.20 sub 9 more broadly applies to all corporations. But that is taking that phrase of that subsection out of context. Because if you read sub 9 completely, it says, in this section. It clearly limits those parts of sub 9 to those entities found in 26.20. It is not broadly applied to all corporations, simply those identified there. And I think we can agree that whether it is all only railroads under 2620 or not, that is an argument that does not get to the merits. The merits is the activities of Lake of the Woods Campground and Jefferson Connect as it's found here do not fall to the ambit of 2620.
Okay.
Do we agree to that?
The parties agree that he is not liable under 2620 because he's not a railroad?
Well, I think the position of the petitioners is that 26.21 applies to all people, so it would apply to Kanak and Lake of the Woods. Our position, listen to the trial court and the Court of Appeals, is that Kanak and Lake of the Woods, which we call Markell, are not anything identified under 2620. And if they are not, and you accept the analysis that 26.21 sub 1 refers to in addition to penalties under 2620, that reference point cannot, by matter of exclusion, by matter of definition, include the parties who are respondents in this case against whom petitioners attempt to apply double damages.
Well, was there any penalty under sub 9 applied in this case?
No, there was not.
So the argument is that because there was no penalty, I think your argument is because there was no penalty in 2620, 2621, which is in addition to the penalties provided in 2620, never come into play. Isn't that your argument?
That's certainly one way of looking at it, that there was no penalty to begin with, but it actually talks to, the language is, yes, in addition to the penalties, and the penalties are under sub 9, and sub 9 refers to the corporations within the section of 2620, and we are not.
I'm looking at 2621. Isn't that the provision in play here?
It is, but it's also tied to 2620.
Right. So your position is there was no penalty under 2620. Therefore, under 2621, sub 1 doesn't apply because it's not in addition to the penalties provided in 2620.
That is correct, Chief Justice, that is one of the arguments. I don't want to eliminate the concept that in addition to the fact that there are no penalties applied under sub 9 of 2620, that in addition, the penalty provision of 2620 sub 9 applies only to those entities identified in 2620. So that is a second level by which we can say that 26.21 sub 1 cannot apply to us. The penalties were never applied. The penalties could not have been applied because 2620 does not identify the entities that I represent in this case and before the court as respondents to which it could apply. It's a two-step analysis.
You agree that in the 1905 statute, that statute could be interpreted to cover more than railroad engines?
You're talking about Section 18, and I would say it references Section 17, and I would say to the degree that it does not incorporate us. I do not understand fully the history of 1905, and although I'm getting on in years, I'm not that far back, and it's very possible that the identity of 99% of that Subject 17 is clearly what we understand to be railroad corporations. The one or two items that are listed there that may perhaps not be what you would say say, is a spark arrestor used on a railroad, maybe things that the railroad uses to clean or clear on the railroad, and that is why they were incorporated. I do not know, but what I do know is 17 is not us. And we also know that the statute had been amended at several times since the original enactment in 1905, most recently in 1977. And it's clear that the statute on the books today is 2620 and 2621.1, which references it, and we are not under 2620, a corporation that conducts any of those activities or an individual that conducts any of those activities, and therefore it doesn't apply to us. Sub 9 with regard to damages is something that was not imposed, and it only applies to those parties in that section.
Could I ask you a question, Mr. McCoy? If we focus on 2621.1,
yes.
What is the subject of the sentence?
My mom's an English teacher, so I should probably know exactly what you mean. The subject has to do with additional damages for...
No. What? The subject. I want the noun, that kind of subject, before the verb.
I guess the noun is the statute, 2620. It's referencing, the subject is what goes on for corporations found in 2620, because it says, in addition to the damages under 2620.
The subject of this sentence is the United States, the state, the county, or private owners.
All right.
Okay. May recover. The United States, the state, county, or private owners may recover. May recover is the verb in this sentence. How can the United States recover penalties in addition to the penalties provided in 2620?
In a civil action, if they bring a civil action against any of those corporations, under this provision they would be entitled to double damages, whatever their damages might be.
How would the United States ever get any penalties under 2620?
If they have national forests in the state, I assume, and they were damaged.
Well, I mean, you have a statute here, 2629A, 9B, 9C. We have forfeitures. We have fines. We have another forfeiture. Who brings the action to get those fines?
The actions under 2620, sub 9, are dealing with damages that apply to 2620.
Who brings those actions?
Well, I have to look at the statutes to who brings it, but
I would say it's not the United States. The United States does not enforce 2620. The state enforces 2620.
Well, if the United States has national forest land in the states that's damaged, they could bring an action.
But not under this statute.
2621.
Not under this statute.
Not under 2620. That's your statute that you're referring to.
My point here, Mr. McCoy, is this. The state, it's the Department of Natural Resources that enforces the statute. And when they enforce the statute, if they enforce 2629A, they might get a forfeiture of $500 for a violation, or a fine of $1,000 under paragraph B, or a forfeiture of $500. But the United States doesn't enforce that. Private property owners don't enforce that. And probably, because this goes way back to 1905, county has no authority except authority granted to it by the legislature. So I would say the construction of this statute is that the enforcing authority is the state, and the state gets any fines and forfeitures, so that the United States, the county, or the private owners would not be getting any additional penalties. They'd be getting penalties for the first time under 2621.
Well, that's true, but it's not... 2621 is talking about additional damages in the civil case. It doesn't say who can enforce that in 2620. 2620 talks about damages that can be enforced by the DNR, but 2621 is talking about the civil context over which the DNR does not have control. And it's saying in that context, all these other parties can seek other damages if the acts are willful. 2614 deals with individuals. 2620 deals with those corporations identified there. Additional damage for willful conduct can be brought in a civil context by the parties identified there. There are three separate statutes to deal with those kind of recoveries. They are not inconsistent that under 2620 the DNR could seek those remedies, and under 2621 a broader category of individuals can seek damages. Does not mean that they are inconsistent.
The DNR is the state.
Yes.
They could get forfeitures and they can get fines. So they can get the penalties. And then they could go under 2621 and they could get the double damages. They could get the attorney's fees.
Yes.
They could get the costs of...
if they lost forest land, the state forest, they could do that.
But if the United States tried to go under 2621, this wouldn't be additional penalties. It would be the first time they get something.
That's true, but these are additional damages that can be brought by anyone. And it simply says, in addition to damages within that category, other damages can't be sought for willful or wanton or reckless conduct. And identifies within 2621 anyone else who can pursue those kind of remedies. They're not inconsistent. They provide different ways of seeking redress. 2620 talks about redress by the DNR. 2621 talks about redress by a larger category of potential claimants.
I think you've conceded that anyone can sue under 2621.
Anyone identified within it.
Right. That's right. They don't have to have received damages under 2620 or any penalties under 2620.
Well, that's true, but the statute of 2620 has to do with whom you may sue against.
Yes. And I don't see the word railroads there.
Well, I don't, but clearly the definition of those categories deals with activities that have traditionally been operated by railroads. And while there are a few examples that have been identified that may not deal specifically with railroads, none of the statute of 2620 deals at all with the activities of my client. I need to understand for the court that the factual record of this accident is much different, we believe, than how it was described in this courtroom. The record, as we understand it, and we accept the decision that my clients are responsible for this fire. But the testimony of Mr. Kanak was that he thought he had put this fire out. And it was a flare-up of a fire that had been, to his recollection, put out for a six-week period, people traversing by, and then it flared up. It was clearly something that the parties agree was a negligent act. And in fact, at one point, there were requests to have a determination made that the activities were reckless, and the parties agreed that that would not be put before the jury, that the plaintiffs would only seek a negligence decision at the trial court level. And it is clear that all we are talking about is negligence at this point of the proceeding. And the burn permit is also something that, although requested and obtained by Mr. Kanak at the time, was not something that was required at this particular time of the year by the DNR. And the purpose of that burn permit was simply to let the DNR know that a burn was occurring so they could monitor it and make sure that it was put out.
Counsel, I want to talk about the laws of 1905.
Then we'll go to 1906 and then 1908. So you got to.
Sure.
Now let's talk about 1905. And because I focus on timber trespass and symmetry. And so when you look at the laws of 1905, and Justice Rogensack earlier was talking about Section 17. And I see Section 17 of the laws of 1905 as dealing, again, with timber, but this is when that timber catches on fire. And so that's Section 17. And it says in Section 17, any person willfully failing to comply with the requirements of this section shall be guilty of a misdemeanor, and it shall be punishable upon conviction. So Section 17 I see as the enforcement action for starting a fire. Then I see Section 18, which says, the preface is, in addition to the penalties provided by the preceding section, I see Section 18 as the civil liability for forest fires. And lo and behold, of course, you get the double damages, right? Then you go to Section 19. And that's where I get my timber trespass. Section 19 and timber trespass is, again, the enforcement action. You violate it, and you can be fined and imprisoned, right? And then Section 20 gets to the civil liability for timber trespass. They call it forest trespass. And anyone who's injured, again, it starts in addition. There's a real parallel here, right? It's at the same time, 1905, the same kind of preparatory language, in addition to the penalties provided in Section 19, the preceding section, for willful trespass on forest lands, the state, the county, or private owners upon whose lands the willful trespass was committed, can have a cause of action for double damages. So when I read it in the context of what's going on in 1905 and 17, 18, 19, 20, what's wrong with my view? Because it's inconsistent with yours. In other words, 17 is enforcement, 18 is a private cause of action where you get double damages, 19 is enforcement, 20 is a private cause of action where you get double damages, the first two dealing with burning our wood, the second two dealing with cutting our wood.
The statute as it exists today, let's begin with that, and I think that's a reference point for talking about the statute that you referenced, Justice Bradley, is that 2614 deals with actions against private individuals. 2620 deals with actions against those entities described, which are largely railroad corporations with some exceptions. 2621 only references damages to apply to those corporations identified under 2620. That's announced the Court of Appeals, Circuit Court. If the legislature had intended for 2621 to apply more broadly as it now exists, it could have simply incorporated 2614 as part of its preparatory language of 2621. It chose not to do so. It made changes to the statute in 1977 because the application of the statute as it existed on the books resulted in two decisions in 1974 that would not allow municipalities to bring actions for remediation costs for a fire against private individuals. In order to ameliorate that, they separated into two sections, 26.21, the second section of which now allows that type of recovery for municipalities. Had it chosen to change the language to apply more broadly to all individuals, including those identified in 2614, it could have done so then in 1977. It chose not to do.
1905, though? What's wrong with my read of 1905, what was going on then?
Well, my read of what the statute says there is 18 refers to the section above, which it says, in addition to the preceding section. It limits it to 17, and 17, in large part, the way I read it, deals with railroads as best as I can apprehend.
It says engines, boilers, and locomotives.
all other engines, boilers, and locomotives operated in, through, or near forest, brush, or grass, which do not burn oil as fuel. That's what the statute says.
Well,
that's the 1905 statute.
Yeah, I'm trying to get to it, Chief Justice.
All right.
If you read the statute, all I can tell you is my interpretation of 17 is that if you read it in context, the entire section talks about activities conducted by railroads. Those things that you describe are activities that are conducted by railroads. And if we use that as a reference point and come to today's statute, we see that that theme is maintained with regard to Section 2620. There's a separate section that deals with that. There's a separate Section 2614. And I'm not looking at this statute except using it as an analogy, G, because 26 is before us.
It seems to me that, and I haven't looked very carefully at this, but it seems to me that Section 17 and then what became Section 2620, that took on a lot of changes over the years, 2620, but that 2621 did not.
The most recent change that I'm aware of is that occurred in 1977. But its reference to the prior statute, section 2620, outside of the fact that the number has changed, is essentially the same. And by and large, section 17 is very much like 2620, although it's broken down in terms of spark arresters on locomotives, locomotive inspector powers, clearing right-of-way by locomotives, operating a railway, combustible deposits on tracks, reports and measures for prevention, and it allows for, under Chapter 2620, which indicates that the intent here is really dealing with railroads, is under Sub 10, it talks about appeal to the Office of the Commissioner of Railroads with regard to anything under that statute. Certainly there's an intent that the overarching concern of 2620 deals with railroads, and 2621 refers directly to it. Now, we may question why a legislature would do that, but certainly this statute, Chapter 20, is very detailed in the kind of damages it allows. It has gone to great lengths to separate damages under 2614 for individuals, 2620 for railroads, additional damages for civil cases under 26.21, one dealing with those involving reckless or willful conduct, and those under Sub 2 with regard to cleanup that are conducted by municipalities so that they may recover those costs of fighting fires against more than just costs for cleaning up public lands, but also private lands. In conclusion, we do not argue that 2620 only applies to railroads. We merely argue that those are to be subject to double damages, those that are to be subject to double damages under the provisions of 26.211 must first have violated some provision of that statute as the statute is written. We have called those groups of persons or corporations subject to the penalties railroad corporations for ease of discussion. Perhaps we should refer them as tortfeasors of 2620.
Now, why can't you read, in addition to the penalties provided in 2620, the concept that all it's doing is saying that 2620 is not exclusive?
Well, if you look for the definition of in addition, which we provide to the court, addition just means that you add to, and you're adding to those damages in 2620. And if it wanted to include 2614, which is all individuals, it would have said so.
Well, you're reading it, in addition to the penalties provided in 26.20 against the persons described in 2620. Isn't that what you're doing? It doesn't make any sense to do that for the reasons that Justice Prosser said, which is that only the state can call for a forfeiture under sub 9.
Well, obviously we disagree, Your Honor. The sub 9 damage provision only talks about those entities within that section.
Who gets the $500 in sub 9? Who gets the $1,000 in sub 9B? Who gets
the state.
9C? That's right.
But another way of looking at it would be, it says in addition to those damages provided. It doesn't say who gets to recover. It doesn't say in addition to the damages the state gets to recover in a 2620. Here's some additional damages it gets to recover.
The point is, it doesn't say anything, and you add words in, and other people can add different words in to the phrase, in addition to the penalties provided in 2620. That's the problem.
Well,
or you think this is clear on its face?
I think it is clear on its face. It references 2620 as in addition to those damages. It also, and I think you have to look at the entire chapter. If you do that, if you look at sub 9 or 2620 dealing just with those corporations, if you look at 2614, the scheme of the legislature is a separate section for individuals, a section for railroads. It has double damage for reckless conduct, and then it talks about the separate sub 2 under 2621 that deals with allowing states and municipalities to recover for cleanup costs in fighting fires for private lands. If the legislature thought that it should be applied differently than it is, it certainly had many opportunities, including in 1977 when it modified the statute 26.21 into two subparts to address the issue that municipalities could not recover against entities for cleanups related to private land or fighting fires.
Why, explain why it makes good policy sense to sock a railroad for double damages on negligence, but not to sock someone who causes hundreds of thousands of dollars, maybe millions of dollars of damages through intentional conduct.
Well, if I'm to articulate a point, I would say that they were given essentially a monopoly in order to build these railroads, and in return, they have some obligation to maintain those lines safely. They are required, at one point, I'm not sure if it's true today, to clear the rights of way every year by fire. In addition, at one point, these spark arresters and what have you created a lot of risk. And I think there is something of a quid pro quo with regard to railroads. And you can argue that perhaps some of the arguments made by the DNR in the amicus brief is that there have not been that many forest fires created by railroads. Perhaps the statute has had some effect in reducing the potential because they know they would be subject to additional double damages, not only that, but because of this statute. So I think that there is certainly some basis for wanting to impose that because of the huge presence that they have, the fact that they are given this land and right-of-way to build these railroads, and in return, they are required to maintain these every year by using fires, and therefore the risk is attended, and you want to make sure that doesn't occur. I see my light is red.
Thank you, Mr. McCoy.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Smith, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
I think everyone agrees that 2621 adds something to 2620. I don't think that's in dispute. The question is, to whom does it add liability? I submit that it supplements, it does not supplant the liability in 2620. What the legislature did was try to prevent what happened in the Jackson case that I cited, the Tenth Circuit case. A railroad company in that case starts a fire, is subject to a similar possible double damage award, and it argues, well, you know what, we've got one statute that applies to us, therefore the double damage couldn't apply to us. We have a strict statute, a narrowly construed statute against us, therefore the more general statute does not apply. I think that's all that the legislature was doing by putting this lead phrase in there, simply saying that, you know what, being liable under 2620 doesn't get you out from under 2621. That does no harm to the legislative intent, even assuming that there was a legislative intent to doubly punish railroad corporations. Railroads are still responsible. It simply makes sure that everybody else that does the same thing as railroads is also responsible. To address the last point that Mr. McCoy made, he's right. Railroads did have a monopoly. They did have certain obligations. We have Section 192.44, which imposes strict liability on railroads, regardless of whether they violate 2620, regardless of whether they violate 2621. They have another statute dealing with them specifically. So any overarching concern that their right to have this monopoly should somehow be attended with a higher risk, well, there's your higher risk for you.
Council, no one was penalized under 2629, was it? 26.20 paren 9 paren.
No, they weren't.
And Mr. Knapp couldn't have been penalized under sub 9, could he have been?
I've never analyzed it, but I would say for the sake of argument, that's probably a safe assumption.
Yes. Thank you.
Now, something that the court asked earlier to Mr. McCoy was about the record, and I think that what we were getting at was how negligent was Mr. Knack. I understand what Mr. McCoy's position was, but we had a four-week jury trial on this. The jury did not believe his side of the story. The jury agreed with us. He's correct that we did have some discussion about recklessness and whether that should go on the verdict, and that was ultimately dropped because the point was we had trespass and nuisance claims. We could have recovered separately for reckless conduct under those. So we have negligence as one claim, reckless trespass, reckless nuisance as another claim. But we simply said to the court, why are we going to have a separate question on a higher standard of care? If they were negligent, that gets us our trespass damages and our nuisance damages. We don't have to go on and worry about whether there was some sort of reckless misconduct. That's why that wasn't on there. It had nothing to do with this particular issue. And frankly, I don't think recklessness is the same thing as gross negligence, but again, the law is so wishy-washy on what gross negligence actually is, this court deemed fit to get rid of it as a common law principle. On that point, I do note that the legislature does use the term gross negligence in some circumstances. By my count, there were 26 statutes out there that the legislature has specifically used the term gross negligence. It certainly knew the words. It could have stuck the words into this particular statute. It didn't. It had an opportunity, as Mr. McCoy concedes, in 1977. It didn't use those words. We've got a statute that has no direct object. It doesn't have any limitation to whom it applies. So the only thing the defense can really hang its hat on is the fact that this expansive language, which everybody agrees adds liability, they have to flip it over and say, you know what, that's actually a limiting term, and now because we don't fall under 2620, we don't fall under 2621 as well.
The argument that you just made, that there are 26 statutes that use the term gross negligence, if gross negligence has been abolished, why didn't the legislature just say, oh, the Supreme Court has spoken, you've got to amend this?
As a common law doctrine, the legislature can put whatever standard it wants in there, assuming that it's constitutional. This court abolished common law gross negligence. That doesn't affect the legislature's ability to come in and say, you know what, we still want gross negligence for very limited purposes. And it does use it for very limited purposes. I submit if you do a Westlaw search, you'll see how limited it is.
Well, but aren't you arguing here that when this court abolished gross negligence, it in effect amended the statute 2621-1?
I submit it actually amended the statute in 1914 when it said negligence means gross negligence. It cleared up that amendment in 1962 when the court did what I think it should do now and say, you know what, it says negligence. Why don't we read it on its face to say negligence rather than gross negligence?
Well, this court, we might not all agree on this, but I would say that this court is not infallible, but generally speaking, when a decision is made, it goes forward.
I agree. It did go forward.
Which part are you agreeing to?
Well, the first part depends on how the court rules on this particular case. The second part, I submit that the court did what it did in 1914, and in 1962, 1972, regardless of whether it was saying it was fallible or not, said, you know what, we're changing course. There's been developments in the law, developments in our way of thinking about negligence and gross negligence. It's too confusing to apply. Let's just get rid of the concept. For all purposes, from Bielski forward, gross negligence was gone as a common law doctrine. The common law is what made negligence in this statute gross negligence in 1914. Go ahead, Chief.
The legislature amended these statutes after Bielski, but it didn't add the words gross negligence.
That's correct. It amended in 1977. Bielski was 1962. I see my red light is on. If I may just take a moment to sum up.
I think you had your time, counsel.
Fair
Thank
enough.
You.
Thank you very much.
That terminates our hearing in 07 AP983, Heritage Farms, Inc. versus Markel Insurance Company et al. Thank you to both counsel for arguing an involved statutory interpretation case. As you know, the court is always interested in statutory interpretation and involving a 20th century, early 20th century case involving railroads and fires. So that concludes our argument. Thank you. I have to read my materials. I'll be back.